The fifth Sunday in Ordinary Time. A reading from the Holy Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 5, verses 13 to 16. Jesus said to his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth. But if salt becomes tasteless, what can make it salty again? It is good for nothing, and can only be thrown out to be trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hilltop cannot be hidden. No one lights a lamp to put it under a tub. They put it on a lampstand where it shines for everyone in the house. In the same way, your light must shine in the sight of men, so that seeing your good works, they may give the praise to your Father in heaven."
Near the Sea of Galilee, Jesus is walking fast and alone through a village and through fields and meadows to where his apostles and disciples are waiting. The welcome they give him is really touching, and with much joy the apostles tell how well their first evangelizing mission went. Later that evening, a circle of attentive faces is with Jesus as he gives them a greater understanding of evangelizing. "Listen," he says, "both you apostles and you disciples. You apostles have already heard these concepts, but now you will understand them in greater depth. You disciples have never heard of them, or you have heard only fragments. You must engrave them on your hearts, because I will make a wider and wider use of you as Christ's flock is becoming more and more numerous. The world will attack you more and more violently as its wolves will increase in number against me, the shepherd, and against the flock. What is sufficient for the herd is not sufficient for you, little shepherds. If the sheep are allowed to make mistakes, browsing in herbs which will make the blood bitter or desires crazy, you are not allowed to make the same mistakes, leading a large herd to ruin. Because you must realize that where there is an idolatrous shepherd, the sheep either die of poison or are devoured by wolves. You are the salt of the earth. But should you fail in your mission, you would become a tasteless and useless salt. Nothing could give you flavor again, since God could not give it to you, considering that it was given to you as a gift and you have dissolved it. If you have washed it in insipid dirty water of mankind, by sweetening it with the corrupt sweetness of sensuality, and thus mixing the pure salt of God with the corruption of pride, avarice, gluttony, lust, wrath, and sloth, then there would be a grain of salt to 7 times 7 grains of each vice. Your salt, therefore, would be but a mixture of stones, in which the poor grain of lost salt cannot be found, which are screeching under your teeth and leaving in your mouth the flavour of earth that makes food disagreeable and disgusting. It would not even be useful for an inferior use, as the flavour of the 7 vices would harm every human activity. The salt, then, would only be spread and trodden on by the careless feet of the people. And how many people would therefore be able to tread heavily on the men of God? Those chosen men will allow the careless people to trample on them, as they no longer are a substance employed to give the flavour of noble heavenly things. They are nothing but corruption. You are the light of the world. You are like this mountaintop, which was the last to be kissed by the sun and the first to be silvered by the moon. High places shine and can be seen because even the most dreamy eye looks now and again at high spots. I'd say that the physical eye, which is said to be the mirror of the soul, reflects the yearning of the soul. It is a yearning often unnoticed and always alive as long as a man is not a demon. It is a yearning after heights where reason, by instinct, places the most high. And searching for heaven, at least sometimes in life, the eye looks at heights. I beg you to remember what we have all done since our childhood entering Jerusalem. Where do our eyes turn? To Mount Moriah, triumphantly crowned with the marbles and gold of the temple. And where do we turn our eyes when we are in the enclosure of the temple? We look at the precious domes shining in the sun. How much beauty there is in the sacred enclosure spread in its halls, porches, and yards. What is up there strikes our eyes. I beg you to remember what happens when we are on the way to some place. Where do we turn our eyes, almost to forget the length of the journey, the tiredness, the heat, and the dust of the road? They turn to the mountaintops. Even if they are not very high, even if they are far away. And what a relief it is to see them appear, if we're walking in a flat, unchangeable plain. Is there mud on the road? There is neatness up there. Is it sultry on the plain? It is cool up there. Is the view limited down here? It is wide up there. And only by looking at the mountaintops we feel the heat of the day less, the mud not so slippery, and the walking not so painful. If there is a town shining on the mountaintop, no eye will refrain from admiring it. We could say that even a modest place becomes beautiful if placed, almost like an airy place, on a mountaintop. That's why in the true and false religions, the temples were placed when possible on high spots. And if there was no hill or mountain, they built a stone pedestal, thus building with human labour the elevation on which to lay the temple. Why is that done? Because men want the temple to be seen so that its light will remind mankind of God. Likewise, I said that you are lights. In the evening, when you light a lamp in the house, where do you put it? In a hole under the oven? In the cave used as a cellar? Do you close it in a chest? Or do you hide it under a bushel? No, you do not. Otherwise, it would be useless lighting it. The light, instead, is placed on top of a shelf or is put on a lampstand, so that being high up, it may brighten up the whole room and illuminate the people living in it. And precisely because what is placed on a high spot is to remind men of God and to illuminate, it must be able to fulfill its task. You must remember the true God. Thus you must ensure that you do not have within yourselves the sevenfold paganism. Otherwise, you would become profane high places with thickets sacred to this or to that God, and you would drag into your paganism those who look at you as the temples of God. You must bear the light of God. A dirty wick, or a wick not nourished with oil, smokes and gives no light. It has a bad smell and does not illuminate. A lamp hidden behind a dirty quartz crystal does not create the splendid gracefulness or the dazzling effects of light on the bright mineral. It fades beyond the veil of black smoke that makes the crystal cover dull. The light of God shines where wills are zealous in removing every day the scum produced by work itself with its contacts, reactions, and disappointments. The light of God shines where the wick is immersed into plentiful liquids of prayer and charity. The light of God multiplies into infinite splendid reflections, as many as the perfections of God, each of which excites in the saint a virtue practiced heroically, if the servant of God keeps the untackable quartz of his clear soul from the smoke of every soiling passion. The unattackable quartz is, then, unattackable. Jesus thunders out this conclusion, and his voice resounds in the natural amphitheatre. He continues, "Only God has the right and the power to scratch that crystal, to write his most holy name on it with the diamond of his will. That name then becomes the ornament that emphasizes the brighter facets of supernatural beauty on the most pure quartz. But if the foolish servant of the Lord loses control of himself and loses the sight of his mission, a completely and solely supernatural one, if he allows false ornaments and scratches instead of engravings to be cut on his quartz, that is, mysterious and satanic figures made by the hot claw of Satan, then the wonderful lamp no longer retains its intact beauty, but it cracks and breaks, and the fragments of the splintered crystal suffocate the flame. And even if it doesn't break, a tangle of marks of unmistakable nature forms on its surface, and soot penetrates and spoils it. Woe, three times woe, to the shepherds who lose charity, who refuse to climb day by day to take their flock upwards. I'll strike them down and remove them from their positions, and I will put out their smoke altogether. Woe, three times woe, to the masters who reject wisdom and become saturated with a science which is often opposed and always proud. If every man is destined to become like God through the sanctification that makes man a son of God, then a master or a priest should already have in this world the aspect of a son of God, and that aspect alone. He should have the aspect of a creature entirely devoted to souls and to perfection. He should have such aspect to lead his disciples to God." Remember those words. In her autobiography, Maria Valtorta writes, "The Spirit of God blows where he wills, and the will of God can send whomever he wishes to take the place of the salt which has lost its savour, so that creatures will not be left without his word." As Maria Valtorta, the human creature, I was the least of all. But when speaking by the will of God to those more ignorant than I was somebody. For God granted me the Spirit without measure, seeing my upright intention, which was to make known his word and lead young hearts to him. And in one of her very last writings, Maria says, "The Master, infinite wisdom, has filled his chosen ones with his salt, and has given them the power to transmit this salt, which must season, to their successors. The Master, the true light of the world, has filled his chosen ones with his light, and has ordered them to illuminate every man and transmit this power to their successors. Moreover, he, as the eternal pontiff, goes on infusing salt and light into the mystical body, so that they will never be lacking therein, even if lukewarmness in members might produce a scarcity of salt and of light."
Azariah, Maria's guardian angel, says, "To say God has loved me in an extraordinary way is not to commit a sin of pride if you say this and God sees you with one sentiment and one will alone, that of magnifying the Lord for what he has done for you." Did the divine master perhaps not say, "When a lamp is lit, it is not placed under a bushel, but on high, so that it will be seen and give off light"? And is it not further stated, "The just will be like stars"? God lights them. God lights you. Oh, the man who goes on a solitary road at night raises his head, and even if he does not know the name of each individual light, he is able to say to himself, "This is the way to go to my destination." For the stars passing overhead from east to west give him the direction of the cardinal points. So it is with the instruments of God. They must shine. They must be lofty in their special sphere where God has situated, separated, and secluded them from the rest of the world, with their names and addresses unknown. Sometimes they themselves are unknown as special instruments, for years even after their death. They must, however, shine. But how? By the sanctity of their lives, by tireless work obedient to God's desires, and by their love and other virtues which, at the right moments, magnify the Lord for the great things done in them. But they always illuminate, because the Lord, living in them completely, shines and casts forth from them his light and his holiness. And like sailors lost on a dark, tumultuous sea, spirits head towards these solitary beacons, battered by the storms of the enemy and by the enemies of God and of his instruments. But they are strong and heroic, always ready to receive the light and beam it upon the shipwrecked, so that they will be saved.